Hello, my name is Carissa Terranova, and we're doing a podcast for Creative Disturbance. I'm here with Philip Beasley, of Philip Beasley Architect Incorporated and Living Architecture Systems Group out of Toronto, Canada. Hi, Philip.
Hi, Carissa.
So tell us about the role of biology in your architecture design practice.
It's interesting to think about how biology makes a contribution to new architecture and sculpture. I'm part of a circle at the University of Waterloo. I'm rooted in architecture, and I work with engineers and psychologists, and also with poets and chemists. And we are circling around the idea, in fact, the conviction, that new architecture can speak of living systems. Now, living systems have been with us for all of culture. And if we think of Pygmalion, we could think of the myth of trying to impart lifelike qualities into sculpture and into the built environment, hoping, yearning for a kind of breathing presence. But to speak about literal biology, literal living systems, feels like a step forward. It's a dangerous step. It's a step into presumption. It's a step into a kind of responsibility of setting off chains of consequences. Perhaps it's a step into the mode of being a sorcerer's apprentice.
But hubris, potentially.
Possibly hubris. And possibly great sensitivity. And possibly simply precision.
And some other kind of sustainability, maybe.
Which I think that there's catch-all. A hope about sustainability and resilience and adaptability.
I'm interested or fascinated by you touch on sort of the past and then the future. So with respect to the role of biology, broadly speaking, in architecture, can we see connections between something like expressionist architecture from 100 years ago and then the use of synthetic biology or what you're doing and that's now and looking into the future? Or are these completely different realms?
I wonder if I could paint two pictures to answer that. I mean, first, perhaps we could picture some of the work that collaborators and I are doing right now. Imagine that hanging in quite a large studio is a generous set of thermally expanded, diagrid, meshwork, ghost-like structures, all linked together resiliently, laid throughout with arrays of microprocessors and sensors and actuators that are chorusing together with small loops of connection amounting to quite larger scale choruses and shifts and waves of response. Imagine manifolds of glasswork running through that structure as well, so that there's exchanges of liquid chemistry, primary metabolic reactions. Imagine also some work in looking at how people walking through such a construction are thinking and feeling and responses in empathy, responses in quite frankly emotional, most fragile exchanges. That kind of amalgam makes for something like a mongrel, you know, I mean, a hybrid that is chorusing together that might be said to have a very direct conversation with biology. Now, if I twin that together with a vision of, say, of work of 100 years ago, or perhaps 70 years ago or so, I think of some early expressionist work, great primal strokes being set out, trying to capture a sense of essential truth of materials, constructing in environments, speaking about a tremendous hope. Of course, the technologies might be different, and perhaps the tuning of the materials might be rooted in a different palette. But it seems to me that a generation associated, say, with the League of Nations right after the First World War, or perhaps even work at the end of the 19th century thinking about incredible potential of the emerging sense of the psyche, this sense that things are interrelated in the most subtle of ways, that time and space, in fact, are continuously related. If I think about a couple of generations that I just named, then they seem to have a tremendous conversation with work that's happening today.
A continuity.
So I would say that there's a tremendous affinity.
Especially, I mean, for sure within architecture, I see it, and that's, I'm interested in drawing those connections. But when you first responded, were you not describing your contemporary, your current practice, which is living architecture?
We are now calling it living systems. We've been calling it near living for a while. And before that, we were calling it responsive. In the optimistic sense of that word, if you walk into a shopping mall, you expect the doors to open before you. And so we might actually take for granted reflexive conditions in architecture today.
Well, one of the interesting things about the work you're doing and one of the other podcasts we did a couple months ago with Sophia Roost, who's at Harvard in the history of science, is the nature of complex systems, the way they're being instrumentalized in new ways and materialized in new ways, is that they begin to blur the boundary between the non-living and the living.
If we work with biology from the legacy of, say, human stem cells or donors of living tissue, then we have one very complex whole body of work to reckon with. And the origins of that material, the questions of whether somebody has donated it or not, or of who's using it.
Where did it come from, its origins?
And where it goes.
Right, and what it's used for.
And what happens when it's synthesized and when it creates new
right, and when does when does it stop being eugenics, and when does it start being eugenics? Or how do we think eugenics in the 21st century?
Can we speak of eugenics in anything other than a tone of horror?
Right.
So if we work from the top down, then, from the body of full-blooded living systems and then the opportunity to resynthesize and engineer and inflect them, we have a very complex body of work. On the other hand, it does seem possible to work with inorganic systems, inflected by knowledge.
That's what
of
you do,
systems.
Right? Isn't that what you're doing with your objects you make or your components that you make?
I have a lovely collaborator, Dr. Rachel Armstrong, now at Newcastle, who has been teaching me about synthetic biology rooted in inorganic processes. Quite simple recipes of chemistry.
Well, like what?
Disarmingly simple.
Can you mention them?
Well, for example, a Traub cell modeled by Dr. Traub at the end of the 19th century as a model of amoebic action is potassium ferric cyanide, aqueous solution working with copper sulfate or copper nitrate. The intersection of those two solutions or those two chemistries produces a lovely operation of osmosis in which a ferric kind of material is deposited and then is progressively pumped by osmotic
action. So like a metal or a steel or an iron?
It's a felt material. It's a metallic felt, which then under osmotic pressure tears progressively. New solution is pumped in through the tears, which then results in more depositing in it. And the on one hand, pure kind of movement and the kinetic action is compelling to see this kind of process happening and to see physical form blooming. But also the form language has a very particular kind of quality. The fissuring and the growth and the cycling of pumping results in a deep reticulation, a kind of trembling, an upwelling,
that's
an efflorescence.
So wonderful.
And that's utterly different than the kind of world of the seed crystal that we might think of when we think about what truth is according to Plato.
Plus, also 100 years ago, again, in architecture and the role of the crystal. So
absolutely,
this begins to be a different paradigm. Did you look at this through some kind of a microscope? Were you watching this coalesce and you said bloom? Did you see this material bloom?
Yeah, we look through the microscope. We look through cameras.
Did you see it physically?
We look directly.
Was it in a petri dish?
This kind of process is quite tangible. It's large enough to be able to watch very directly. The work that we're doing right now is housed in glass flasks because it makes great sticky messes when it's out of the flask. But we are working to make fibers and skeins and nets that could clothe the exterior of scaffolds. That's one of the ambitions of this work, is to
cladding?
Do something like ivy cladding a building.
Yeah, so exactly. But it'll be a whole new way of thinking of Bekleidung, that architectural idea, German concept of cladding.
Yeah.
In the role of representation or semiotics. Yeah. I'm not sure how that will all work.
But that's very different than, say, the crystal that we might think of a
what
century
you're talking
ago.
About, yeah. Yeah. And probably Bekleidung, too, is not quite right.
Well,
because it's flat and attached, but it had the idea, the suggestion that it could be read as something having almost like a semiotic meaning. I'm not sure that works here.
Well, it's what you're raising touches on one of the incredible hinges in this kind of work, to my mind, because we start to look at what is original and what generates things and what is fertile. And I think I would say that I've been taught that a generative thing needs to be pure, needs to be a distilled seed, a crystalline,
right,
pure truth.
Exactly.
Something, you
from,
know, a core needs to be one.
From Plato to what the early 20th century in architecture.
And that kind of reductive vision is one that has pervaded my culture. But I'm absolutely fascinated to find, I have been fascinated to find, that there's some very different voices that speak of original things in utterly different terms. One is Lucretius, the tradition of the atomists, who speak of a different geometry than the reductive crystal, the geometry of the clinamen, which is the
Kleinemann's
minimum derivation of a tangent, which is at its heart much more of a fluttering or an eruption, or you can say swerve, but that might
well,
be
that
too intangible.
That also, to me, that simplifies it. I mean, I've never heard it discussed or described the way you were describing it just now as a flutter. By the way, we'll talk more about that idea shortly, because we'll come back to it. And just really quickly before we wrap this up, would you tell us a little bit about what you did with the UT Dallas Brain Health area of study or offices this morning? How it might relate to, what were you doing in brain health? Or if you could just say something quickly or summary.
There's a rather nice symmetry with the discussion that we've just been having about the origins of things, alternating between, say, crystals and tremulous efflorescence, I mean, two very different ways of thinking about origins, and the discussion that I just had with Dr. Sandy Chapman and the Center of Brain Health. That institute is quite revolutionary.
Here in Dallas.
Here in Dallas, in the States and in the world, in coming to know the plasticity of the brain as being a tremendously involved, delicate, involving structure, which rather than being something which is mysterious and needing to be treated with reverence behind the black box of the skull, is something that can be very actively played with, and it becomes a medium. So the idea of the conversation that we were launching this morning is that the near-living, active metabolic architecture, which we have been weaving and spinning and engineering, could have a very happy symmetry with the kind of what the body of studies at the institute. Mm-hmm. And so we are at the early stages of contemplating making an environment in collaboration with the center.
Okay, so my very last comment or question is, then are you developing architectural components, building components that are interactive.
We make interactive architectural building components fundamentally, and we are very committed to durability and to reliability and to participation in the world. But the models of design that we're using are turning out to be rather different than those that have been taught by the Vitruvian tradition of architecture, which says something must be tough and reduced and rigid, rather
and everlasting.
We're discovering that unapologetic delicacy and fragility and interlinking systems can make for a really quite extraordinary kind of resilience that can be an absolutely responsible kind of architecture, not simply a fatal excess.
And we hope that it gets economically feasible and widespread, hopefully. So thank you so much, Philip, and we look forward to more discussion with you here in Dallas as the weekend goes on.
Thank you, Carissa.